once and for all, in line with its claimed commitment to protecting media freedom. The U.S. offered a number of so-called assurances that were crucial to the successful appeal. U.S. officials claimed these assurances included that Julian Assange would not be subject to special administrative measures or held at a maximum security ADX facility and could apply, if convicted, to be transferred to a prison in his home country of Australia. The U.S. assurances were described in Friday, 10th of December ruling by Lord Burnett of Maldon, the Lord Chief Justice, the Lord Justice Holroyd, as solemn undertakings offered by one government to another. They remitted the case to the Westminster Magistrates Court with a direction to send the case to the Home Secretary Priti Patel. Stella Morris described the High Court's ruling as dangerous and misguided and a grave miscarriage of justice. Speaking outside the Royal Courts of Justice, Stella Morris said, "Today is International Human Rights Day. What a shame. How cynical to have this decision on this day." Alarm at the High Court ruling was expressed by advocates of press freedom, with Amnesty International describing the ruling as a travesty of justice. Niels Muiznieks, Amnesty International's European director, said, "By allowing this appeal, the High Court has chosen to accept the deeply flawed diplomatic assurances given by the United States that Julian Assange would not be held in solitary confinement in a maximum security prison." Rebecca Vincent, director of international campaigns at Reporters Without Borders, said, "The court ruling marked a bleak moment for journalists around the world," and called on the U.S. government to drop the case. The High Court was told earlier this year that blocking Julian Assange's removal from the United Kingdom due to his mental health risked rewarding fugitives for their flight.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, the people and the region as a whole. And as always, we will explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives and make the alternative voices heard. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss Bangladesh's growing clout 50 years after its independence and how major world powers are vying for its attention. And we shall look at recent events in India's industrial city of Gurgaon, where open spaces are shrinking for Muslims to pray amid attacks by Hindus.
The remarkable economic growth of Bangladesh in recent years has captured global attention, with the world's two largest economic powers wooing Dhaka. China has been making deep inroads in the South Asian country, investing massively in its infrastructure, much to the chagrin of Washington. On the other hand, the US has been making efforts to rope Bangladesh into the Quad Alliance in order to counterbalance the growing Chinese power in the Indo-Pacific region. Now, the question is, will the dragon prevail over the eagle or vice versa? Only time will tell.
Bangladesh's growth story 50 years since its independence has been a much touted one. The South Asian country, bordering the Bay of Bengal, is projected to have the world's 28th largest economy by 2030. This impressive outlook coupled with its strategic location, has earned the country attention from global and regional powers. Bangladesh figures prominently in the US-China rivalry to win allies in the Indo-Pacific region, with gradual shift of focus towards the Indian Ocean and its littoral states. Bangladesh's location provides a significant strategic value for both Beijing and Washington. China's friendship with Bangladesh dates back to the Defense Cooperation Pact signed in December 2002, which was later upgraded to strategic partnership during Chinese President's visit to Dhaka in 2016. Today, Beijing is the largest trading partner for Dhaka, and most of its defense purchases also originate from China. The deepening economic and security cooperation between the two countries, however, has caused jitters in faraway Washington. In a bid to counter growing Chinese influence in the Indo-Pacific region, United States has been courting Bangladesh to join the Quad Alliance, which Beijing calls a Cold War construct. Chinese envoy to Dhaka recently cautioned Dhaka against falling into the trap, warning that it could substantially damage their relations. It remains to be seen who will prevail, dragon or the eagle.
India played the central role in Bangladesh's liberation war in 1971, which continues to nourish their long-lasting ties. But with the region's geopolitical tectonic shifts, not everything has remained hunky-dory between the two close neighbors. It appears that Bangladesh has finally come out of the shadow of India. Its growing engagement with Beijing amid the China-India tug-of-war for regional influence has worried New Delhi. Plus, the Modi government's Hindu nationalist politics has also contributed to the tensions between the two countries.
For long, Bangladesh lurked under the shadow of India, which was once touted as one of the fastest-growing economies. But in recent years, tables have turned with Bangladesh outpacing its big neighbor on many fiscal, economic, and social indicators. On the other hand, it has completely surpassed Pakistan, from which it broke off in 1971. Bangladesh's growing political and financial clout means it has got new friends and allies, most notably China. The growing engagement between Bangladesh and China is being seen with concern in New Delhi, which has a long-running rivalry with Beijing. Considering its age-old rivalry with Pakistan and signs that traditional allies Sri Lanka and Nepal are also being courted by China, New Delhi fears that Bangladesh too might move into the Chinese orbit. Bangladesh borders India along the latter seven northeastern states, which are mostly restive. In the same region, China also borders India and claims one of Indian states, Arunachal Pradesh. Any tensions or military confrontation between India and China is likely to affect Bangladesh. Relations between New Delhi and Dhaka have also experienced bumps due to Narendra Modi's government's Hindu supremacist politics. Bangladeshi Prime Minister and others have suggested that the anti-Muslim outlook of Modi government has contributed to violence against Hindus in Bangladesh.
Now to have more insight, you are joined by Mr. Tunç Akoç, a journalist and a political analyst. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Akoç. And let's begin by talking about Bangladesh's economic rise and social mobilization in recent years, which has led to shifts in its foreign policy. Now, how do you see its relations with major world powers today?
Hello and greetings from Turkey, from Istanbul. Well, Bangladesh has a balanced relationship with both the superpowers and its neighbors. It has historically friendly relations with India, and in recent years, Bangladesh established strong economic relations with China, and they become strategic partners. Bangladesh also tries to keep good relations with the United States, the country to which it exports the most. But I think it is not easy to maintain this balance policy. Actually, it depends on the economic development
of the country. Bangladesh can become an important actor in the region if it continues to grow its economic power. I think the relations with especially China and India will be good in the future, but the relations with the United States will worsen. As you know, Joe Biden did not invite Bangladesh to the Democracy Summit, just as he did not invite China or Russia or Turkey, Hungary, Iran, Azerbaijan, etc. I mean, the contradiction is this. In Bangladesh, there is strong female labor participation in the economy, or the country has been a significant global player in efforts to fight extremism and climate change. So the reason why Bangladesh was not invited is, I think, obvious. The United States of America is uncomfortable with Bangladesh's geopolitical choices. And we can say, in a sense, Joe Biden punished the country for that reason. Finally, I think the upcoming elections are crucial for Bangladesh's future. And if Mrs. Sheikh Hasina's line wins, the current policies will remain.
So regional rivals China and India are Bangladesh's two biggest trade partners. Does that put Dhaka at the risk of becoming embroiled in the China-India tug-of-war for regional supremacy?
No, I don't think so. These are, I think, two separate and non-contrasting realities for Bangladesh. The first one, of course, currently there are 9 projects running under the Belt and Road Initiative in Bangladesh, including the mega project of the Padma Bridge Railway. And Bangladesh also occupies a strategic position along the Maritime Silk Road with its port, of Chittagong as a major maritime hub through the Indian Ocean. And as we know, China is the top direct foreign investor in Bangladesh. And on the other side, Bangladesh has very strong political and also cultural links with India. And meanwhile, it's geographically almost entirely surrounded by India. And I think Bangladesh's location between China and India, because of that reason, I mean, Bangladesh is a prime candidate, I think, to emerge as a trading and manufacturing hub, And based on this vision, I would say the tensions between China and India will not escalate to the point where the region would be destabilized.
Mr. Akoch, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people on social media see the situation.
Jeff Smith, author and research scholar, cites Chinese envoy to Bangladesh Li Jiming, warning that China-Bangladesh relations will suffer if Dhaka joins the US-led Quad Alliance. India's Foreign Ministry spokesman Arindam Bagchi facilitates Bangladesh on its 50th independence anniversary, recalling that India was one of the first countries to recognize Dhaka. Qazi Fahim Ahmed, Dhaka-based columnist, quotes from an article saying US must not see Bangladesh through India's prism, which he warns will affect US Indo-Pacific strategy.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
India's industrial city of Gurgaon has witnessed communal tensions in recent weeks, with the minority Muslims accusing the right-wing Hindu extremist groups of not allowing them to perform Friday prayers in designated open spaces. Previously, there were over 100 open spaces where local Muslims had the administration's permission to perform prayers, but the number has now dropped to only 20. And what is worse is that the civilian and police administration has failed to rein in these extremist groups and safeguard the rights of Muslims.
Since 2018, intermittent protests by extremist Hindu groups against minority Muslims offering congressional Friday prayers in open spaces in the city of Gurgaon, 30 kilometers south of capital New Delhi, have led to clashes and violence. It has also shrunk the number of open spaces earmarked for Muslims to pray from more than 100 to 20 or even less. A few weeks ago, members of right-wing groups again began to disrupt Friday prayers in the city known as the industrial and technological hub of India. The city has about 500,000 Muslim population. In a provocative move, trucks were parked in the area designated for prayers. When Muslims protested, the administration buckled under the pressure of extremist Hindu groups. Pertinently, last month, an umbrella organization of Hindu groups called Sangyukt Hindu Sangharsh Samiti had warned to use weapons and go to jail if the Muslim prayers were not stopped. Now they have vowed to keep protesting until no more open spaces are left for Muslims to pray. Local Muslim groups believe it is a deliberate attempt to disturb peace and communal harmony. They have taken up the matter to higher authorities, but without any luck so far.
The recent events in Gurgaon did not happen in a vacuum. The seeds of Hindu-Muslim tensions were sown soon after the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party came to power in India in 2014. The party has been accused of pursuing the majoritarian agenda and fanning the flames of violence against vulnerable Muslims across the country. By silencing progressive voices and othering the minority communities, the Modi government has empowered Hindu supremacist vigilante groups. This policy polarizes Hindu voters against Muslims and brings election victories for the BJP.
Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party has managed to create a sense of Hindu victimhood, stoking sentiments against Muslims in a country where Hindus are a whopping 85% while Muslims are barely 14%. By empowering Hindu vigilante groups and refusing to provide justice to Muslim victims, the government has allowed religious divisions to deepen further. Under the Modi government, mob lynching and hate crimes have assumed alarming proportions while marginalization of Muslims has become a part of the ecosystem. Social media is replete with videos of self-appointed Hindutva champions calling for lynching of Muslims for crimes ranging from offering prayers in open to eating meat. Sometimes the provocation is simply the Muslim identity. Violence against Muslims has been normalized to the extent that Hindu groups in India now attack mosques and ransack homes if anti-Hindu riots are reported in other countries. The incidents in Gurgaon came weeks after Hindus went on a rampage against Muslims in the Indian state of Tripura. There have also been protests and threats to remove street vendors selling meat-based snacks in several cities of India's Gujarat state, which shows that religious minorities in India are being denied equal access in public spaces. That's the India of today Mahatma Gandhi would definitely not be proud of.
Now, to have more insight, I'd like to welcome Mr. Ahmad Hussain to the program, the spokesperson for Muslim Public Affairs Committee, UK. Now, Mr. Hussain, open places of worship for Muslims are rapidly shrinking in India's industrial city, Gurgaon, as right-wing Hindus have been campaigning against it. So what is driving this frenzy?
Firstly, thank you for having me. So what's going on in Gurgaon? We've got a city of 1.5 million people and it barely has 20 mosques. For comparison, if we look at the English city of Birmingham with 1.1 million inhabitants and has over 200 mosques, we can see that there's clearly a need for these large public open spaces to be used by Muslims, because Hindu supremacists have already ensured that there aren't enough mosque spaces. So this current frenzy is being fed by people who just want to continue making life difficult for Muslims. And who's driving this frenzy? It's organized Hindu supremacists, groups like the RSS, who want to see a greater Hindu-only India, some kind of a mythical solution for modern India's problems.
So why are the authorities in Gurgaon and other Indian cities caving in to the pressure of extremist Hindu groups rather than standing up to them and protecting the rights of the minority Muslims?
So to understand what the Gurgaon authorities are doing and are going to do, we have to look at the political context. So Gurgaon, the area, was generally a Congress seat until the 2014, when it flipped to the BJP, and in 2019 the BJP grew their voter share there. So the Gurgaon authorities' priorities are going to be the BJP's priorities, and the BJP is basically, simply put, a manifestation of the RSS's Hindu supremacist grassroots. And when you look at the words of the leaders and the politicians of the BJP, and this isn't something that they try to hide, they openly call for the genocide of Muslims. So these supremacists are the voter base of the BJP. So the BJP has a vested interest in instigating tensions with the Muslim community and then framing themselves as the only party that will destroy this self-created problem, this self-created enemy.
Mr. Hussain, would you hold the Narendra Modi-led Hindu nationalist government in New Delhi responsible for empowering these Hindu supremacist vigilante groups?
I hold Narendra Modi responsible for basically continuing the policy that he started as a governor of Gujarat in 2002, when he basically instigated a pogrom that led to the death of 2,000 Muslims, led to the rape and the destruction of lives of countless others, because this is how he works. This is how he works. He makes his rich friends richer, and he scapegoats Muslims and distracts his poverty-stricken voters and supporters by blaming Muslims. But I also hold responsible the Muslim global community for allowing our leaders to greet people like Modi like a bigger brother, to quote a certain Muslim leader. Muslims need to be organized behind campaigns against people like Modi and join organizations like MPAC UK.
Now let's take a look at what the global media has to say about this situation.
Every Friday for months, members of Hindu vigilante groups alongside local residents have been gathering, occasionally armed with axes and wooden rods, at the sites of namaz to try to stop them happening. Slogans including "shoot the traitors" have been shouted and Hindu prayers and songs read out to try to drown out Quran readings. Cow dung has been placed at the sites and police have regularly had to hold back the mob so namaz could continue. In Gurgaon, for the past 3 years, Muslims have been pushed out of those common or public spaces where they used to gather on Fridays for their customary collective namaz. Their number in Gurgaon is approximately 5 lakh, and nearly a lakh of them, men to be exact, are out in the day for their work on different locations. There are only 13 mosques in Gurgaon. Muslims have an obligation to offer this collective congregational prayer on Fridays, and it is mostly a half an hour affair. India is losing leverage in South Asia as its government tries to reshape the country into a Hindu state. In marginalizing and maligning its minority Muslims at home, Mr. Modi's government has weakened India's traditional leadership role of encouraging harmony in a region of many fault lines. The shift could also open opportunities for China, which has used the promise of investment and access to its hard-charging economy to cultivate stronger relations with its rivals' neighbors.
Now, recently we've seen Hindu groups attack mosques, ransack shops and homes owned by Muslims in the Indian state of Tripura after anti-Hindu riots in Bangladesh. Doesn't that seem that anti-Muslim violence is now being normalized in India?
Yeah. So what does it look like when anti-Muslim violence is being normalized? I mean, are mobs roaming free without arrest? That's happening in Tripura. Are those who spoke out against violence being harassed by the authorities? That's happening in Tripura. Are the police being accused of participating in the violence? That's happening in Tripura. And look, everything that happened in Tripura was instigated by the VHP, an affiliate of the RSS, which, remember, is the grassroots Hindu supremacist root of the BJP. And why do I point this out? Because you need to understand, it's politically necessary for the BJP to keep Hindus angry and distracted. Thus, for as long as the BJP seeks or holds power, anti-Muslim violence is always going to be normalized.
Last but not least, Mr. Hussain, how has the India of Jawaharlal Nehru and Maulana Abul Kalam Azad changed since 2014 when Narendra Modi's right-wing Bharatiya Janata Party came to power?
The vision of Nehru and Abul Kalam was of a united India, but that vision has been bloodied by the butcher of Gujarat coming into power. So for those in India, whether Muslims or Hindus or Sikhs or so on, for those in India who want to see a united India, they have to start by kicking out the BJP. And for those of us outside of India, those of us who want to support the oppressed victims of the BJP, we need to be united and organized. We need to stay updated through channels like Press TV, and we need to join organizations like MPAC UK.
Thank you for your time, Mr. Hussain. Hope to have you back on the program again.
Thank you for having me.
Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
New Delhi-based journalist Sagrika Kisu, commenting on recent events in India's industrial city Gurgaon, notes that 108 open spaces for Muslim prayers have come down to 20 in 3 years. Steve Hank, economist at Johns Hopkins University, cites the case of popular Indian Muslim comedian Munawwar Farooqi, who had to cancel 12 shows in 2 months due to threats by Hindus. Journalist and TV anchor Srinivasan Jain says the violent radicalized majority has taken over the country, while referring to vandalization of a school in one Indian state.
And that was our episode about the US-China competition in wooing important Indian Ocean littoral states like Bangladesh and the marginalization of Indian Muslims by the nationalist Hindu government. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Leaked documents show Sajid Javid, Britain's health secretary, received a presentation from the Health and Security Agency recently, warning that even if the Omicron variant leads to less serious disease than the Delta variant, it risks overwhelming the National Health Service, with 5,000 people admitted to hospital a day. We have prepared for you an article written by Tom Ambrose. The piece is titled, Scientists Say Omicron Could Cause 75,000 Deaths in England by End of April. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Experts experts have told the UK government Omicron variant could cause between 25,000 and 75,000 deaths in England over the next 5 months without tougher COVID restrictions. Scientists from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine also warned that Omicron, first discovered in southern Africa, is likely to be the dominant coronavirus variant by the end of the month. Even in the most optimistic scenario, projected infections could lead to a peak of more than 2,000 daily hospital admissions, with a total of 175,000 hospital admissions and 24,700 deaths between 1st of December and 30th of April. The scientists who advised the government as part of the Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, or SAGE, and the Scientific Pandemic Influenza Group on Modeling, or SPI-M, use experimental data to look at how the transmission of Omicron variant might develop as the country heads into 2022 without more stringent restrictions beyond Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Plan B. Another 633 Omicron cases were recorded in the United Kingdom on Saturday, 11th of December, marking the largest daily increase since the variant was detected. According to the UK Health Security Agency, it brings the total number of confirmed Omicron cases to 1,898. Overall, a further 54,073 new COVID cases were reported on Saturday, with 132 deaths. Dr. Nick Davies from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, Centre for Mathematical Modelling of Infectious Diseases, who co-led the research, said on Saturday, "These are early estimates, but they do suggest that overall, Omicron is outcompeting Delta rapidly by evading vaccines to a substantial degree." Dr. Nick Davies said, "If current trends continue, then Omicron may represent half of UK cases by the end of December." They also found that booster jabs provided additional protection against Omicron, with a higher uptake likely to reduce the number of infections, hospital admissions, and deaths. Scientists predict bringing in additional control measures early next year beyond Plan B, such as restrictions on indoor hospitality, the closure of some entertainment venues, and restrictions on how many people can gather in one place, would reduce hospital admissions by 53,000 and deaths by 7,600. Dr. Rosanna Barnard from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine's Centre for Mathematical Modelling of Infectious Diseases added, "In our most optimistic scenario, the impact of Omicron in the early part of 2022 would be reduced with mild control measures such as working from home." Dr. Rosanna Barnard added, "However, our most pessimistic scenario suggests that we may have to endure more stringent restrictions to ensure the National Health Service is not overwhelmed. Mask wearing, social distancing, and booster jabs are vital, but may not be enough," adding, "Nobody wants to endure another lockdown, but last resort measures may be required to protect health services if Omicron has a significant level of immune escape or otherwise increased transmissibility compared to the Delta variant." However, Professor Paul Hunter of the University of East Anglia said any model was only as good as its assumptions, adding that one key assumption here was that severity of disease outcomes for Omicron was the same as for the Delta variant. He said, "Although we will not know for certain for a few weeks, indications from South Africa suggest that Omicron does cause less severe disease compared to the Delta variant." He added, "If Omicron is indeed associated with less severe disease, as is in my view likely to be the case, then these models would overestimate hospital admissions and overestimate deaths, possibly substantially." He noted, "As better data becomes available in the coming weeks, we can expect these models to be refined." Professor Eleanor Riley from the University of Edinburgh said earlier on Saturday, 11th of December, that Omicron was spreading so fast that people were very likely to meet someone infected with the COVID variant unless they were living the life of a hermit. Professor Eleanor Riley warned that a lot of people could still end up in hospital even if Omicron is found to provoke milder symptoms than the Delta variant. Professor Riley told BBC Radio 4's Today programme, "Omicron is spreading so quickly that I think unless you're living the life of a hermit, you're very likely to come across it in the next few weeks." Professor Riley noted, "I don't think anyone should be going around thinking they're not going to catch it. I think that situation has changed." A spokesperson for the government said it continued to look closely at all of the emerging data, adding, "Plan B remains a proportionate response based upon what we know, so we encourage everyone to follow the rules by wearing a face covering, working from home if you can, testing regularly, and coming forward for your booster shots when called." Meanwhile, young people not currently eligible for the COVID-19 booster jab have been receiving vaccinations from walk-in centres, clinics and pharmacies across the United Kingdom that have chosen to ignore official government guidance. On online forums, those aged under 40 have been suggesting to each other the places offering booster shots to all over 18s. On Reddit, nearly 25,000 people are a member of the UK community Get Jabbed, where they are sharing locations of clinics in cities including London, Manchester and Liverpool offering booster shots to younger people. One poster linking to a vaccination clinic in Essex said they were offering the jab within 5 minutes of arriving, no questions about age or living in the area. Another reported getting a jab in Smethwick near Birmingham, while other under 40s said they had been vaccinated recently in Woking, Surrey, in Basildon, in Essex, in Hounslow and in Bristol. Many say they want the booster shots to protect older relatives or because they expect to be away or busy when the rollout to younger people officially happens next year. Despite the fact that they were flouting official guidance, many walk-in clinics offering booster shots to anyone over the age of 18 appeared to be keen to advise that they have jabs available. At the Yorkshire Event Centre at Harrogate Showground, 28-year-old Jessica Jones said her father heard on the local news that there were vaccines available for younger people. Jessica Jones, who runs a set building company for fashion shoots in Manchester, is one of a small percentage of under 40s without pre-existing conditions to have now had a booster shot. She said, "The main reason I've come here really is that my dad is quite old and that I still want to go places and do stuff. It's the obvious choice. No one wants to get ill." Dr. Catherine Dixon, who runs the vaccine centre in Manchester and delivered Jessica Jones's booster shot, said the aim is to vaccinate as many people as possible, regardless of their age. She said most of the older and vulnerable people are now up to date with their vaccines, so we're seeing more younger people coming in. But NHS England has not officially rolled out vaccine booster shots for under 40s, with a spokesperson saying NHS vaccination sites are expected to focus only on the most vulnerable, which at present is people aged 40 and over, as well as those with health conditions and healthcare workers. The NHS said from Monday, 13th of December, this will be extended to over 30s, advising anyone eligible to get the jab. Booster shots are becoming increasingly vital in the fight against the new Omicron variant, which is predicted to become the dominant variant in the United Kingdom within days. Early analysis by the UK Health Security Agency found a third dose of the vaccine prevents three-quarters of people from getting any COVID symptoms. Professor Neil Ferguson, who helped shape Britain's coronavirus lockdown strategy, said the Omicron variant has the potential to very substantially overwhelm the National Health Service, and cause up to 10,000 hospitalizations a day if it is virulent as the Delta variant. The mathematical epidemiologist from Imperial College, University of London, said the United Kingdom was already experiencing a very explosive wave of infection from the new variant. This could lead to quite an explosive wave of hospitalizations. In addition, leaked documents showed that Britain's Health Secretary Sajid Javid received a presentation from the UK Health and Security Agency recently warning that even if the Omicron variant leads to less serious disease compared to the Delta variant, it risks overwhelming the NHS with 5,000 people admitted to hospital every day.
Economic divide.
A major gas deal signed at the recent ECO summit, Azerbaijan, Iran, and Turkmenistan agreed to swap Turkmen gas, having the potential to show how Iran can become a transnational gas hub. Iran is, after all, located geographically in a perfect place. Hi, I'm Kavit Akhli. This edition of the program, we will discuss how this deal came about and what it means for West Asia region. Coming up, Azerbaijan, Iran, and Turkmenistan, they were the ones that signed this natural gas swap deal. Iran's president is saying this will strengthen ties between the three countries. Obviously, that's a point that this government is looking to expand on. Next, we're going to take a look at how Iran can become a gas hub, something that potentially it is now. It can be a key gas supplier, and it has the potential of becoming a major transit route, whether it's gas or even oil. Another highlight of this program will be overcoming U.S. sanctions. Obviously, that is something Iran's president has said, that U.S. sanctions will not hamper Iran's interaction with its neighbors, this gas swap deal being one example.
The Economic Cooperation Organization. The organization comprised of all five Central Asian countries, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan, as well as Afghanistan, Azerbaijan, Iran, Pakistan, and Turkey. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, in his debut there, said member states of the Economic Cooperation Organization enjoy great capacities that can bring about economic prosperity in the region.
Mr. Chairman, esteemed presidents and prime ministers, the current era is the era of Asia, which is the cradle of civilization, culture, and rich values, and also the cradle of monotheistic religions.
And he remained true to his pledge. Iran entered a gas swap agreement with Turkmenistan and Azerbaijan on the sidelines of the 15th meeting of the Economic Cooperation Organization. According to this gas swap deal, Iran will get Turkmenistan's exported gas at the joint border to use it for Iranian provinces, and in return will deliver the same quantity of Iranian gas to Azerbaijan Republic at its border with Iran. In total, the gas will cater to the needs of at least five provinces of Iran.
The swap deal is one of a kind due to the avenues that this opens up for similar deals to take place. And looking at social media posts, it shows that Iran's natural resources, like gas in this instance, can't be kept out of the world market, including its transit routes. Well, taking a look at this comment, it says, whoa, very good news. Now it's on paper that Iran is everywhere and that all nations need Iran. Only Israeli and the U.S. are getting fire and heat. Best wishes to the Iranian people and government from India. Now, this particular viewer writes that the correct questions need to be asked. And the questions to ask is, who is earning the least from this agreement? And who had to recall their other regional claims and demands? In this case, it is the same party. Can you guess who it is? Well, if you can guess who that country is or what that guest is talking about, write to us with an answer. Our links and addresses are on your screens. All right, here's another viewer comment. What, we supported Azeris against Armenian, and now Azeris backstab Israel by supporting Iran? Maybe the correct question to ask is that, is this beneficial for the parties involved? And Israel is not a party. Joining us in this segment to get some answers on the significance of this gas swap deal is our guest, Matthew Everett. He's an editor-in-chief at the Canadian Patriot Review. He's also senior fellow at the American University in Moscow. He's also the author of The Clash of the Two Americas and founder of the Rising Tide Foundation. Also joining us in the studio, we have Ahmad Saleh. You have been absent from our program, so we figured it's a good time to call you back.
My pleasure.
Thanks for coming. He is a political economic analyst and also, based on what I'm seeing, a fiscal and monetary policy analyst and an energy economy commentator. Welcome.
Thank you.
All right, let me first start with you, Matthew, if I may. We're looking at what has occurred at this ECO summit, on the sidelines of this summit, where Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan and Iran have signed this trilateral of what's called a gas swap deal. Tell us why this is so important, because that's the way it has been reflected in different periodicals and specialty magazines in the energy sector. What's the big deal about this?
Well, this is an incredibly important development for a variety of reasons. Number one, I think contextually speaking, context is everything. And looking at the world right now, there is a major struggle over what will be the operating system which comes online, replacing the collapsing Western unipolar system, which is in a terminal phase of collapse. And that's something that people really need to chew on if they haven't realized this yet. That is a defining characteristic. And at the end of a system, there's a lot of opportunity as well as a lot of danger. The opposing system, if you want to look at what is shaping that other operating system, which is the more preferable one in my opinion, and I think in the opinion of those who are participating in this trilateral agreement, is the multipolar system being led by China, the Belt and Road Initiative, and many of the Eurasian countries who are increasingly jumping on board that orientation. So far, the idea of divide to conquer has been the nature of the game, keeping people stuck on a monopolized resource like oil or petrol, and then getting various participants to fight over diminishing returns and inflaming different localized interests, so that there are many fire starters within the entire Caucasus, the Middle East, the Central Asian region that have been induced to really just create chaos on behalf of Western manipulators. So we've seen this really burn the entire region for the past 20 years especially, and many of those participants, people who have been, interests who have been utilized by Turkey, by Israel, by the United States, have come to realize that they are ultimately disposable in the grand scheme of things and want to have a future.
Okay, thank you for that. Well, he looked at things in a grand scale.
Yes.
So let me ask you whether you agree first, and of course what your thoughts are as to why this deal, this gas swap deal, is made out to be such a big deal. Our guest has said that, and many other places are reflecting it as such.
Yes. As my colleague mentioned, some of the global aspects from a political perspective, which I also agree with all he said. Let me look at this event from another perspective. First of all, it comes after the recent unrest or somehow conflicts between Iran, Azerbaijan, and Turkey, which we witnessed. So it is a very good news for the region and for the stability in this region.
Firearms and Youth section is upon us, and there were lots of stories that caught our attention from this past week. So let's get started. Now, this is just bad news no matter how you look at it. The OECD is warning that Omicron is threatening the world economy. It spelled it out quite logically, that outbreaks could continue to prompt restrictions on people's movements, which could have long-lasting consequences on labor markets or production capacity, and of course, prices. It said the recovery has lost momentum, and it has cut the outlook of top economies, including the U.S., China, and the Eurozone. Moving on to our next topic, U.S. racial inequality, something that is plaguing the U.S. quite a bit. And this actually is not a recent piece of news. It was recommended by a viewer. So here it is. It's about how the racial inequality has cost the U.S. economy $51 trillion since the year 1990. The key drivers behind that, persistent gaps in rates of employment, education, and earnings, to name a few. Now, this is a great topic for a program which we will bring to you in the near future. On to our next topic, Palestinian entrepreneurs. That caught our attention. The title of the entry was actually Entrepreneurialism in West Asia and Africa, that not enough attention is paid to this. However, we are. It said that the West Asia and North Africa is increasingly drawing attention from investors. When it comes to Palestinians, from health to education to affordable energy, Palestinian startups are shaping their society. Finally, U.S. Civil War? Yes, you are seeing that correctly. A U.S. billionaire has that prediction for the U.S. His name, Ray Dalio, and he has said that there is a dangerously high risk that the U.S. could slide into a civil war within the next 10 years due to the exceptional amount of polarization. He said a 30% chance is where it stands of such an outcome because the rules of governance are being ignored in the United States.
Listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Hello and welcome to our in-depth section. In this section, we're going to review Iran's natural gas possibilities and capacity and see how Iran can be transformed into a natural gas hub. In terms of the proven gas reserves, where Iran holds 1,183 trillion cubic feet of proven gas reserves. That sounds like a lot. Obviously, anything in the trillion sounds like a lot. But to put that into perspective, and this is as of the year 2017, it ranks second in the world. When it comes to the world's total natural gas reserves, that's about 17% of the world's total natural gas reserves. Now let's take a look at Iran's geographic position from the eco lens. You're going to see a map here in a second. This is Iran. Take a look at some of the countries that are in the vicinity of Iran in terms of its neighbors. And there you have these pipelines, whether they're oil and gas. Now the reason we're showing this to you is Iran has the capacity geographically to have these pipelines to transport either oil and gas to different parts of the world relative to where it is located. So when you take a look at to the east, to Turkey, to Azerbaijan, which we just talked about, the topic of this program, Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, these two very important because they are landlocked countries. So they will, Iran can accommodate them. In a matter of speaking. And of course, you have the two big consuming economies like China and India, of which there are gas pipelines and oil that can be incorporated in order for them to become obviously large customers for Iran. So the geographic position of Iran here is very important, as just explained. Now, let's move on to how Iran can actually become a regional gas hub. That's not far from reality. Here, we're looking at what has occurred already. Iran has made forays into this gas relationship with its neighbors, like the Iran-Russia gas swap, That's in the works. Iran is ready to participate in a gas swap between Pakistan and Turkmenistan. However, a long-planned pipeline to transport gas from Turkmenistan to India is unlikely to become operational. You also have the Iran-Pakistan-India gas pipeline. All right. Let's take a look over here at how you have this deal that divides up the Caspian Sea. This is important, again, because the Caspian Sea, being part of Iran, obviously is shared between countries like Russia and you have Azerbaijan. Take a look at these five countries: Russia, Azerbaijan, Iran, Turkmenistan, and Kazakhstan. The Caspian Sea, it's obviously an area that's rich in oil, gas, and caviar, of course. But in terms of the oil and gas energy that's available through the Caspian Sea, that also remains an option for Iran for it to expand, take the energy that belongs to it, and then again, based on the pipelines that we just showed to you before, expand that to its neighbors. Rejoining me in the studio to discuss this matter and more is Matthew Everett, the editor-in-chief of the Canadian Patriot Review. Okay, Matthew, so we're looking at Iran having the world's second largest reserves of natural gas after Russia. Now, this swap deal for Iran is important because it deepens ties with Azerbaijan and Central Asia. But in the bigger picture, what are the possibilities of Iran becoming and transforming itself into a regional gas hub?
I think it's looking better and better by the day. Obviously, there was a hiccup in 2016 when the energy deal, the cooperation between Turkmenistan and Iran, was cut off. This is now being revived once more, and you really need to have economic cooperation, a sphere of trust building and collaboration amongst all of the different neighboring regions, both for Iran's sake, but also for its neighbors. Iraq, Syria have seen devastation over the past years, who desperately require reconstruction. Iran right now is a key hub, not only because there is, for the first time ever, rail lines being built between Iran and Iraq. It's a very small connection, but this could easily extend with the help of China, increasingly, who is very much interested in creating stability throughout this entire region, into Iraq, into Syria as part of a broader reconstruction package, into Lebanon, which desperately needs it. And if you, I mean, just look at any of the countries right now who are not invited to the upcoming democracy summit, which has excluded half of the world's population.
Indeed. Okay, let's see what Ahmad Salehi thinks, our guest here in the studio. Ahmad, so you heard our guest there, Matthew, talk about this, and you kind of touched on this in terms of the not only infrastructure that Iran has and has been building, but also the fact that Iran, in terms of its geographic location, in terms of the reach that it may have, for it to be or to transform into a gas or energy hub. What are the possibilities of that, and how does that stand in your view?
Actually, taking into account that there is a strategy shifting in the energy sector of Iran, and that strategy shift is that Iran is not going to export its oil anymore, or at least for the next 10 years, because as I said, the consumption, the domestic consumption is equal to the production at the moment. So our neighbors also know this. So this paved the road for a better cooperation between us. And Iran used its capabilities in terms of geographic position and the pipeline network inside Iran that can connect all corners of Iran and the countries surrounding Iran. As I said, big producers of gas, natural gas, are our neighbors, and even some emerging new consumers of energy in terms of gas are our neighbors, like Pakistan and India. So this is going to be a cooperation between the countries of the region rather than competition. So this is the paradigm shift in the energy sector of Iran. Even in the crude strategy, we are seeing that instead of exporting crude oil, Iran is doing refineries, petrochemical refineries, implementing some petrochemical refineries plant inside the country, and exporting, like as Matthew said, petroleum or gasoline to Lebanon, etc., etc. Because when we export crude oil, those who wants to put embargoes and limits on these exports have a very easy job.
Great, thank you so much. It was a pleasure having you, Ahmad Salehi, in the studio with us, political economic analyst, fiscal and monetary policy analyst, and an energy economy commentator. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Economic
Thank
Divide.
You. My pleasure.
Why would Iran want to import gas when it has so much of it? Economically, it would be more cost efficient for Iran to import gas